I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. How do you weigh quality of life against quantity of life? Deborah Nussbaum wrote in the Philadelphia Inquirer recently about her mother's decision to forego chemotherapy treatments after being told that her cancer had returned. Her mother said, "I had the surgery and now I'm done. I've had a great life. What happens to me happens." Well, that story caught our eye, and we asked Deborah Nussbaum to join us on Radio Times. She's an adjunct journalism professor at Rowan University, a freelance writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, also business development director for a law firm in Marlton, Highland Levin. And Deborah Nussbaum, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Well, it can be scary and lonely thinking about and making decisions about end of life. Palliative care's goal is to relieve suffering and to improve quality of life for people facing serious and chronic illnesses. And that's why we asked Dr. Michael Levy to join us. He's vice chair of the Department of Medical Oncology at the Fox Chase Cancer Center. He's also a professor on the Fox Chase Cancer Center faculty and an associate professor of medicine at Temple University School of Medicine. He also founded and is the director of the Pain and Palliative Care Program at Fox Chase. And Michael Levy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
Deborah, let me begin with you. How is your mother doing?
She is absolutely terrific. She's at her home in Longboat Key, Florida. She's 86, still living on her own and doing very well. And she doesn't drive at night anymore, but most 86-year-olds, I think, are giving that up. And so far, she's doing great and really has no regrets about her decision.
Well, I have to say your article about her caught our eye. And when she made that decision, essentially to forego treatments for the cancer that had returned, were you surprised that she said that?
No, Marty, because she actually made the decision a couple of times. In the spring of 2010, she was diagnosed with uterine cancer. And I should mention that 25 years earlier, she had had breast cancer and was fortunate. She just had a lump removed and radiation, and the cancer never returned. And then in March of 2010, she was diagnosed with uterine cancer. She had a hysterectomy. And following that, her doctor suggested chemo. And she said, "No, I'm, you know, in my 80s. I'm feeling well. I want to enjoy the life I have." Then when a PET scan in the summer of 2010 showed two spots in the pelvic region, she didn't flinch. She said, "Let me enjoy whatever time I have." And we've been, as I said before, very fortunate. She is doing great.
And her doctor was okay with her decision?
No, he was, I mean, he's an oncologist. His job is to, you know, encourage people, I think, sometimes to have treatment. But he told my mother that he has a 90-year-old patient from the Philadelphia area who comes up for chemo every week. And my mother said, "That woman must be crazy." So, you know, she definitely has a sense of humor about it. And she if she were in her early 70s, she would absolutely have it. She's not opposed to modern medicine. She just feels like at her age, it would do more harm than good. But it's different for everyone, but that's how she feels.
And I do want to get Michael Levy in on the conversation, but Deborah Nussbaum, has she been living differently in the last year or so since she decided to forego this treatment?
No, she has really been enjoying life. I do think, if anything, she might be a little more adventurous. She and I and one of my sons just went out to Wisconsin for a long weekend for a baby shower. We flew out there, and I think she's a little more, you know what, I'm going to go, because maybe in a year or two I won't be able to go. And so I think it's, if anything, she has a better attitude. She was always positive, but now it's even better about life.
Well, Michael Levy, let me get you in on the conversation. How common is this, what we're hearing Deborah Nussbaum say about her mom?
Again, coming from a cancer center, patients come there because they want therapy. So at Fox Chase, it's uncommon that patients over 75 don't want therapy. They might have just stayed in their community hospital. In fact, our organizations, the oncology organizations, have gone out of their way to make sure they don't exclude patients who want it. And there are special geriatric assessments to help us know how to do it safely, put in extra supports.
Interestingly, Deborah was saying that when her mother's doctor, an oncologist, said, "No, I want you to continue treatment," you had a kind of physical reaction to that.
Well, I think the most important thing is that we not just assess a patient's problem, but assess their goals. And oncology cares for patients who are experiencing cancer. And what the most appropriate response from that oncologist would have been, then you should get connected with a palliative care program. Right. You know, the patients have the right to accept or refuse any therapy we offer. I think it's important that we don't present, you know, no chemo doesn't mean no care. And if the oncologist can't directly provide it, then there are palliative medicine doctors and teams who can.
And so what is palliative care?
So palliative care is a focus on optimizing quality of care for people with life-threatening illness. And it focuses on the physical, the emotional, the psychological, the existential, the financial aspects of serious illness, and tries to bring in supports. I mean, in one way, it's kind of the kind of comprehensive medical care we did 100 years ago when we didn't have all these other things.
It does feel kind of old-fashioned in a way. I mean, very hands-on.
Mm-hmm.
Deborah, going back to you, does your mother see a doctor?
Yeah, she sees her cardiologist 3 or 4 times a year, and so she does have checkups in that way. But she has not gone back to the GYN.
And does she talk about dying?
She does sometimes. I mean, sometimes she will say, you know, maybe I won't be here next year, and we try to be encouraging. And, you know, sometimes she's funny about it. She signed a 2-year contract for her cell phone and said, well, the joke might be on AT&T because maybe I won't be here. And she laughed, you know, which I think is good medicine. But I think the best thing, and when I interviewed, Dr. Levy for my story,
yes,
is doctors being able to, you know, work with patients and give them an honest assessment. I know my mother-in-law was diagnosed with cancer a few months before my husband and I were married 25 years ago. And we, you know, he was very blunt that she had liver cancer that had spread, and if we wanted to do anything important, do it now. And we moved up our wedding, and that was really her last good weekend. Mm-hmm. So I think that one of the beauties of doctors like Dr. Levy is, you know, letting people know what they have in life so they can make those decisions and do important things.
You want to add to that? I mean, this is so critical to how someone thinks about their life and even thinks about their death.
Often I think of my job as being a tour guide, that I know the journey that a patient will probably take, and I try to give them advice of good places to go and places to avoid, and then help them with full knowledge. They have the knowledge about chemotherapy, but they don't have the knowledge of palliative care, so it's my responsibility to let them know that that is an option. And in fact, our vision is that people with advanced cancer will all get palliative care, and some might get chemo.
I wonder, too, because everyone is so different. Some people want, you know, they want the barefaced news. They want it. They want all the hard language. Some people want to sort of dress it up a little bit. You have to figure out how to talk to people about this stuff.
Well, information is therapy. And like any medicine, chemo or any drug, you have to make the right diagnosis and give the right dose at the right time. And so we need to ask a patient, what do they understand? And how would they like us to share the information? And they'll tell us. And some will say, talk to my kids. Most will say, let me know what's going on.
Right.
And then you also ask, what have you been told? You know, because with the internet and TV, they have some sense they have a serious illness. And then you hear what they say and you use those words because they won't be shocking. And then you take them to a point that they'll be able to make a decision.
Deborah, going back to you, and it doesn't sound like your mother has depression, but was there ever any question about either her state of mind or even being depressed when she made this decision?
No. She's very, very been you know, almost upbeat about it, and she has never ever wavered on this. And you know, we've discussed it with her a few times. But I want to add to that, after I wrote the story and it appeared in the Inquirer, I received many emails from people. And I would say that the most painful family situations were the ones where people had never discussed what should we do, you know, if mom or dad gets sick. And then the parent was too sick to make a decision. And then the family was left not knowing what to do, and in some cases, terrible family disputes about what to do.
Because there's a difference of opinion, you have a different relationship with that particular parent.
There were, in fact, one letter I got was about a man who was sick for 6 months, and one of the sisters wanted to continue treatment, and one, you know, wanted to let, and the rest wanted to let dad die peacefully. And it just became this horrible, you know, he was in and out of the hospital. And when he died, the mother said to the girls, don't put me through that. This is my decision. So I just think people need to talk about these things as uncomfortable and painful as they are.
Do you see that as part of your job, which is to bring families together to have this conversation, Dr. Levy?
Yes, I think that's the part of understanding their goals and expectations. And the whole process of advanced directives is not whether you have a living will that's a piece of paper, but that you and your physician and your family, you know, are hoping for the best but prepare for the worst and share that communication, and not just what I don't want done, but what are my values? What do I want to leave as a ethical will to my family? But still, less than 25% of Americans have living wills.
Is that right? Yeah. I wasn't sure where that stood today. So that there's not a lot of progress on that front. And is that just because no one wants to think about their death? No one wants to plan for their death or think about or talk with their family members about it?
I think there is a myth that information destroys hope. And so I think if we face reality and you have good support and your family support, you might need to realign your hopes.
Right.
But I think, you know, it's interesting. It's kind of the first difficult thing when you have a family is life insurance. And then maybe disability insurance. But then we don't get to that piece. Because you should talk to your adult children about what you'd like and how, what kind of care you'd like, and talk about values. And the problem, it does take time. And that time is hard to find and not well reimbursed. Efforts to get it reimbursed actually got co-opted into the health care reform and then became death panels.
Mm. Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. And that's Dr. Michael Levy. He founded and is director of the Pain and Palliative Care Program at Fox Chase Cancer Center. On the telephone, Deborah Nussbaum, and she's an adjunct journalism professor at Rowan University and wrote an article not so long ago in the Philadelphia Inquirer about her mother's decision to forego cancer treatments. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY, talking about the ethics and etiquette of end-of-life decisions. We'll be right back.
The Geographical Society of Philadelphia supports WHYY and presents a season of film, adventure, and food from around the world. Society events run through May at various Philadelphia and mainline venues. The four-day GeoFest begins November 7th with the National Geographic Genographic Project and ends with the Digital Nomads Journey from D.C. to Antarctica. Information at geographicalsociety.org or 610-649-5220. The Geographical Society of Philadelphia. It's almost like being there.
On the next Fresh Air, Tom Ricks, author of the bestseller Fiasco about the invasion of Iraq, discusses his new book, The Generals, about what happens when mediocre generals aren't relieved of their command. He says in World War II, generals were held accountable for their lack of success, but that started to change with the Korean War. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Shuti, the India Music and Dance Society, supports WHYY and presents Sounds of India, influences and integration of folk melodies and Carnatic music with leading vocalists as Soumya and Bharat Sundar, supported by violin and percussion ensemble. Saturday, November 10th at 4:30 p.m. at the Science Center Auditorium, Montgomery County Community College, Bluebell, PA. Information at sruti.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking about a tough conversation that involves end-of-life decisions. Our guest, Deborah Nussbaum's mother, decided she didn't want further treatment when her cancer returned, and Deborah wrote about it in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Palliative care is concerned with quality of life and pain management. It can help a patient take control of their life and death. And our guest with us here in our Philadelphia studios is Dr. Michael Levy, director of the Pain and Palliative Care Program at the Fox Chase Cancer Center. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Deborah, talking about family, how does your family, your larger family, feel about your mom's decision?
Well, there's just two of us, my sister and I, you know, the grandchildren and the son-in-laws. And I think because my mom is so strong and positive about it, I think we all support her. And, you know, she's 86. I think if she were in her 70s, we would probably not agree with her and push her, although I don't think we'd have to. I think then she would have done it. Mm-hmm. But I feel, too, that, you know, we've had the conversations a couple of times, so that helps a lot. And I did receive some beautiful letters from families who had those conversations and made those decisions, and it was, you know, really peaceful for everybody, I think.
And have you thought about your own death and the kind of decisions you might make or you want to have made as you get older, Deborah?
Well, you know, I'm almost 58, and I think, you know, for the next 20 years, I would probably want treatment depending on what I had. But I think in my 80s, I might agree with my mother. But I think the most important thing is people's ability to make those decisions while they can make them, and also to have doctors like Dr. Levy who give you options. Really, my mother's doctor, while he was a very good oncologist, didn't really give my mother other options other than the treatment.
And there are other options, as you have said, Dr. Levy, which is that the palliative care isn't the lack of care. It's just a different kind of care for someone who might be in pain or facing a life-threatening illness.
It, in many ways, it fills out care as our focusing on cancer. As our cancer therapy becomes more and more molecular and genetic and DNA, there's so much to know that there's always an interest in learning more and trying new things, so that what seems to work best is when you have collaboration of different teams. You may have the uterine cancer team, but you also have the pain and palliative care team, and the collaboration is what then gives the complete care.
And Deborah, we're going to have to say goodbye to you, but has your mom been in pain at all?
No, actually, she is just doing great. Wow. I mean, she uses a walking stick to walk, but just more, you know, because she's more nervous than physically impaired. But she's actually doing great. She's had no pain, and you know, I think she's happy with her decision. And you know, I have to say too, she's doing great right now. You know, maybe when she doesn't feel good,
right,
I don't know, you know, what will happen then. But, you know, I know, too, that myself and my sister, if we were really in pain or and didn't feel our disease could be cured, we wouldn't want to go on. So I understand her feelings. And, you know, I'm hopeful that what people got from the story was, you know, to communicate with their families.
Indeed. Well, I liked your story very much, resonated with it very much. Deborah Nussbaum, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. Michael Levy staying with us for the rest of the hour, and we do have a full bank of calls. But let me ask you about pain and pain management. Do we know more about pain? Are we better at managing pain than maybe we were 10, 15, 20 years ago?
I think we have the capacity to control physical pain with comfort and function in 95% of our patients. And then they may sacrifice some function if they need higher doses or as their disease progresses. And there's a 1 in 1,000 patients with advanced disease that might need higher doses or different medicines that might induce sedation. So we have the tools. We can do it. It just takes time, skill, and interest.
Well, and I would assume for a lot of people, just the fear of being in pain is pretty powerful.
And also, people attribute meaning to pain that can get in their way.
They should have pain
or they shouldn't have pain. Are they a good patient, a bad patient? The medicine shouldn't work, so I shouldn't have pain. I'm meant to suffer. I've had a patient say, if I have pain, I know I'm alive. And the same day, a patient said, if I have pain, I know I'm dying. Wow. And I want to die, so they wouldn't take more medicine. So it's a very loaded
kind of a Rorschach in a way.
Yeah. And then there's existential pain that you can't treat with medicines, but you treat with information and support and getting the family together.
Because I would think for a lot of people, it's that fear of or loss of autonomy, control over your life. I mean, maybe that is the more sort of existential part of what we're talking about.
I think it is. That's when pain becomes suffering. Pain's a physical experience,
right.
But you can amplify it by saying, oh, this is only going to get worse, they're not going to be able to help me, and it's all my fault. So I've had patients' pain levels go down from a 7 out of 10 to a 3 out of 10 just with telling them what they have and how we're going to take care of it.
Wow.
Didn't give them a thing, but they could reframe it.
And I realize every case is different, but I think for some people it's just hard to talk. It's hard to see someone who's suffering. It's hard to be with someone who might be dying. And from your experience, are there things that loved ones and family members and friends should think about or even say or not say under those circumstances?
Well, no one should ever say, I know what you're feeling, because you can't. So you can say, this must be terrible for you, or acknowledge if they're crying, if they're angry, if they grimace when they move, just note it. Because that kind of empathy, you know, that says, gee, this looks difficult. How can I help?
Rather than trying to take it away, right?
Yes. And also, you should never lie. You don't have to club them over the head with truth. But like a therapy, you give a little bit, find out what they need. Even when they ask, well, doc, how long do I have? It was actually social workers who told me to say, well, why are you asking that now?
Oh.
Or what are your concerns?
Oh.
Or what have you been told? And so it's that back and forth that you go gently but answer their questions. You can't just say, I don't know, because you know more than they do, and they need, they're adults, they need a decision. If they've asked for something, you have to find out what do they want to do, what do they want to know, and help them make the decision.
And as someone gets closer to death, and there always is that sense of figuring out how to say goodbye, what do you want? What does the person want to say? What does the other person want to hear? You must have wrestled with this yourself.
Well, I think Ira Byock has a wonderful book called The Four Important Things You Have to Do When You Say Goodbye, and he talks about you need to say, thank you, I love you, I'm sorry, and I forgive you.
Wow.
If we could all do that with our parents, as I said to my father when he was dying, knowing he probably wasn't hearing it, but I still felt better that I said it, and also felt better that I had resolved issues. We all have issues. I resolved issues.
We do all have issues.
I resolved issues year before just because of my awareness of his illness. You know, I think there's this conspiracy of silence that the patient doesn't want to tell the family doesn't want to tell, and that's what ends up with the dysfunctional behaviors within the family, and each is trying to protect each other, and then all you do is have isolation.
I love the thought of saying, I'm sorry and I forgive you. I mean, obviously you have to take responsibility for whatever you did in the relationship, but you also, the importance of forgiving someone for their mistakes or foibles or
yes,
whatever
and,
they did.
There's a lot of examples of the benefit of the vigil, that some of the unresolved issues, the prodigal children, there's at least an opportunity for closure. I had a woman who was in her late 50s, had advanced cancer, and we had a family meeting. And it was explained to her that her cancer had progressed through therapy, that her liver and her kidneys were so bad and more therapy would only harm her, and that I was recommending hospice referral. And the daughter and the husband are in the room, and the daughter's crying. And I stopped, and again, silence is a skill you have to learn.
Yes.
And she said, well, I guess I'm really lucky. And so I'm thinking, was she listening? Was this shutdown? And in fact, I just waited, and she said, well, everybody knows they're going to die, but not everyone knows that it's this close. And now I have things I want to do and want to share, and I'm going to do them.
Well, sounds a little bit like Deborah's mother, yeah. Or some version of that. Just one follow-up question, then I do want to get to our callers here, because I think there is some confusion between, or at least maybe I have confusion between, palliative care and hospice care.
Mm-hmm. Hospice is a model of palliative care. It was the first model that we imported in the 70s and got paid for by Medicare in the 80s, and it was primarily focused on care at home. Mm-hmm. It's a benefit that was aimed at people in their last 6 months of life, but both the science base of medicine wanting to do more to help and the patient family desire to have more done, the last year the median, half the patients died in a month on hospice of the 1.2 million patients have died within a month. So they're getting too late. So that's the issue, is it is a model basically for when someone wants to never go back to the hospital or the emergency room or the ICU, and they want to spend some good time at home, and then there's no emergency that the team can't handle if that's the goal.
And there is this desire, sometimes impulse, to do more. I mean, there is more that could be done, whether it's right or wrong thing to do, but it seems like there are so many options.
Each disease is different, but we're getting to the point of looking at guidelines. The National Comprehensive Cancer Network has guidelines that will say, this disease, you got treatment one, if that doesn't work, treatment two, and then treatment three might be experimental or supportive care. And we're trying to be reasonable, both in the how it harms patients, as well as then there's the economic issues that are pressing.
Indeed. That's Dr. Michael Levy, Vice Chair of the Department of Medical Oncology at the Fox Chase Cancer Center, where he's the founder and director of the Pain and Palliative Care Program. And we are talking about palliative care, some of these end-of-life decisions. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get to, it looks like Reverend Barry Whitney to join us on Radio Times. And go ahead, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, and I just wanted to say that I really appreciate, Dr. Levy, your saying that you are a tour guide for your patients. I think that is a beautiful way of navigating end of life, and I wish that not only oncology but all facets of medicine did that. I think as a hospice chaplain, the most difficult thing I deal with, which you mentioned, is people coming onto hospice too late and that they don't get the benefits of the comfort care and the team approach. And there, it seems to me that many medical professions don't offer other options than treatment, or there's a fear to address it with the families.
Well, let me pick up on that. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, Dr. Levy.
I think any intervention has to be started at a time that it can help the best. I mean, even medical oncology, when it was first developed 50 years ago, patients actually referred too late for even chemotherapy to help. So we've tried to develop the field of palliative medicine so that it is an intervention that it's unethical not to offer at a time that it would be effective. It does take time, and so we're training, we're teaching. We now have 3,000 physicians who are board certified. There's 5,000 members of our organization. It's not enough to take care of the 2.5 million patients who die every year, but we're trying to get it integrated, to move it upstream, and to make it a hard option, that it really is an intervention that needs to be given at the right time and in the right dose.
Because it sounds like from what you hospital chaplain said, that by being too late, people are suffering needlessly?
Well, they don't have. They're not going to do life review and look at the pictures and talk about the family and if they think they're what next chemo. I mean, we have to get out of the war on cancer mentality. I had to review the War on Cancer Act from 71 and for the President's Cancer Panel, and I read it. And the War on Cancer, nowhere in the legislation did it mention the patient who was treating cancer, not treating people experiencing cancer. No. We've got to change the language. We've got to change the focus. And the American Society of Clinical Oncology is doing that in their positions on individual care for patients with advanced disease, that this is our job.
Interesting. Let me get Whitney from, looks like, Huntington Valley to join our conversation. And Whitney, go ahead. You are on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was a hospital chaplain, actually, for 9 years, a part of the palliative care team. Thank you for your work, doctor, because I know a little bit about that. And that was from 2001 to 2006. I think it's a great program. I wonder, though, and I hope this isn't a non sequitur, but could you address the issue of feeding tubes? I'm not sure. We would run into this problem every now and again, and now the palliative care team I was a part of didn't just focus on cancer patients. It could be a patient with Alzheimer's who is coming towards the, you know, maybe 6 months or less to live, and sometimes they can't decide whether they want to eat or not, and often elderly people just stop eating, and family members have issues with, well, wait a minute, I don't want them to stop eating. What does it mean to have a feeding tube? So I wondered if you might address that issue.
Wendy, it's a great question. Thanks for the call. Go ahead, Dr. Levy.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, first, even in the hospice population, only 36% have cancer in the last in 2011. So it started all cancer. We deal with dementia and debility as the next most common, and then other chronic illnesses. Again, I go back to goal. And so what's the goal of any intervention? And if you haven't had a discussion of the patient saying what they want or don't want, you then have to have the goal discussion with their surrogates and the clinicians. And the medical society has determined that feeding is a treatment. It's not usual and customary basic human needs. So a feeding tube can and should be started with goals and a time limit to achieve those goals and can be stopped as easily as anything else. And then there is data about the dangers and the side effects of nutrition. You know, you can give someone nutrition, they're more awake, they feel more pain, and then they need more pain medicines to get more sleepy. So it really is a dialogue.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Whitney, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We do have a full bank of calls, and we are talking about that all-important decision about end of life and the importance of families talking with each other, the importance of communicating with medical staff as well. And again, our guest is Dr. Michael Levy, Director of the Pain and Palliative Care Program at Fox Chase Cancer Center. We'll be back after this very short break. Stay with us.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra performs the music of George Gershwin. In a concert of American classics, Kirill Gerstein plays Gershwin's Piano Concerto in F. And Giancarlo Guerrero conducts Aaron Copland's joyous Appalachian Spring. Tickets at 215-893-1999 and at philorg.org. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, American classics, Gershwin and more with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll have the latest stories in Sandy's wake. Also, a new film from National Geographic tells the story of the Navy SEAL raid on Osama bin Laden's compound. Was it re-edited by producers to remind viewers of the president's role? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Penn's College of Liberal and Professional Studies supports WHYY. Penn's Master of Liberal Arts allows students to tailor their program to suit their interests. Penn MLA students pursue creative writing and urban studies, global concerns, and applied economics. Instructors and peers share perspectives that can help students hone their thinking and communicate their ideas. Part-time options and evening classes are designed to fit the needs of working professionals. Details online by searching Penn MLA.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Dr. Michael Levy about the ethics and etiquette, for lack of a better word, etiquette of end-of-life decisions. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I just want to pick up on the feeding tube thing, because we were talking during the break about how, I think for most people, especially non-medical people, feeding is food, and food is care, and care is love. And the thought of withholding food, I would think the worry would be that the person would suffer because of that.
Feeding tube should be looked at just like chemotherapy. There's good and bad effects. And what's the goal? If a patient has irreversible illness for which there's no quality of life, no mental, or there's physical suffering, that the more alert they are, the more they feel. If they have coughing, giving them fluids makes them have more secretions and more coughing. So we have to talk with the family and say it is a treatment, and their body isn't able to use the nutrition. They won't feel hungry, mm-hmm. and if there's any distress, we can control that with medications.
And they won't feel hungry?
No.
I mean, it sort of doesn't compute with the body?
If they're feeling hungry, then we might continue to treat the hunger. See, there we're treating a symptom, not treating a problem. Mm-hmm.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Samantha from Morgantown joining us on Radio Times. And Samantha, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was wanting to ask a question about broaching the subject of end-of-life or pain management when you have a patient that's younger, whether it's cancer or any other kind of illness. And how do you start that conversation with your siblings, your loved ones, your family, and have them take it seriously, because it seems like pain is associated with older people, and when you have younger people involved, it's sort of, oh, you'll be fine, you'll get through this, okay, and it's not really a serious sort of conversation.
Samantha, I'm just curious, is this going on in your family?
It actually went on with me. I'm a two-time cancer survivor, and the second time around, the reaction I got many times, for me, it was a difficult thing to go through a second time.
Sure.
But the reaction I would get was, "Oh, you did this already. You'll be fine. You're young. You'll bounce back." And it was sort of not very helpful.
Well, hold on the line. Let me give Dr. Levy a chance to respond.
Well, I think age does make it more difficult to families to give support, but it's the same thing. What are the goals and expectations? And we can't say anything to family members that isn't consistent with their experience. So if the patient has pain, they have pain, and then you just have to ask, how can I help? And just blowing it off that, oh, it'll be fine, that's that conspiracy of silence that then you just said. It isolated you, wasn't helpful. And so we really need, first you need the tour guide for the physician. Here's what's going to happen, and what good and bad, and what we expect, and then you share that with your loved ones, but it's challenging because it's not just undertaught in clinical professionals. It's undertaught in our society, and we need to get values of life. And I would also say that this isn't just about end of life care. This is life care, and we need to.
You're still living,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
Samantha. I'm just curious. What, looking back at that period of your life, what did you want?
Well, I guess I think the doctor kind of hit on it. I just wanted them to sort of acknowledge that as a young person, I mean, I had chronic pain for about 3 years after my first treatment, and I didn't have chemo or anything. It was all surgical treatment, which, you know, sort of which one's better. There's that whole, you know, it's six and a half, one dozen of the egg, or whatever that saying is.
Sure.
And you go through enough surgeries, you get it to a point where you just don't want to get cut open anymore, and you want to walk away from any kind of a treatment if it happens again. So I guess looking back, my expectations, which I thought I was very clear in sharing, but I guess not, was that I just felt like I wanted some acknowledgement, really. It was what it came down to.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I think you've said something very important. Dr. Levy, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I think the concept of post-treatment pain, again, why this palliative care just is an end of life, we see a large number of cancer survivors who are left with nerve pain from different appropriate surgeries, and they often are belittled, and your CAT scan and bone scan's negative, you shouldn't have pain, but you do, and then the neuroscience tells us how it can occur, and then had a patient, a young woman who had an axillary dissection, breast cancer surgery, had pain for 3 years, and she came up because her neighbor had been seen by us. We said, well, look, this is why it's happening, and there's medicines, some of the antidepressants, some of the anti-seizure agents. We said, this is what it is. Here's what we're going to do. And she came back in a month and was significantly better.
Wow.
And in another month, she actually ended up being angry at her other doctor because she could see, this wasn't so hard. Why didn't I get this where I started? So it's knowledge, it's time, and again, it's information.
And Samantha, thanks for calling into Radio Times. We have a doctor from Downingtown calling us. And go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to share my experience in that my wife was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, received the Whipple procedure, and unfortunately, this was done in August and March. She developed metastatic cancer to the liver.
I'm sorry.
She was went to the oncologist. The oncologist told her, "Oh yeah, we can give treatment." So said, "Well, what would it do for me?" And she said, "Well, you might get a year." And she said, "And if I take no treatment, what would I expect?" She said, "Well, maybe 3 months, right, and then hospice." So she said, "Well, I don't want any treatment because I want to feel good in whatever time I have left." The oncologist said, "Well, then you don't need," and that was her dismissal. What Dr. Levy is offering, I think, is extremely important. She received magnificent care in hospice. The hospice nurse was able to monitor the pain medications, and we had 3 different ones by the time she passed away.
Wow.
But she was kept comfortable, which was the one thing that she expressed. She did not want to die in pain.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I'm glad. I'm sorry she died, obviously, but I'm glad it was what she wanted. Dr. Levy, anything you want to add to that?
Well, actually, one of the chemotherapies for pancreatic cancer was one of the first chemotherapies that the FDA approved as palliative chemotherapy. That it didn't have that many side effects, and the small shrinkage of the tumor actually helped relieve the pain in a way that medicines might have been sedating. So we have to, again, what are the options? And then I think continuing to care about the oncologist, because that's the one who knows cancer medicine, then collaborating with others. So it shouldn't be a dismissal. It should be a collaboration.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Is there such a thing as a good death from your experience?
I think so. I think that we had a big conference on bereavement years ago with all of the thought leaders and researchers, and then I had to explain it to an AP wire writer. What are we talking about? And basically, I said, if you have a relatively good life, you have relatively good care for your disease, you'll have a relatively good death, and your family will have a good grief. And he thought he was at a peanuts conference. But
with the good grief part,
yeah,
right.
But it's there, but first, how many people even think of a good life? I mean, one of the problems is most of the quality of life studies, no one asks the public what's your quality of life before the illness. So I think we all need to have more mindfulness and awareness and get some sense of what we're doing, and then the disease will add pressure to it. But I think surveys that looked at what does the public define as a good death talk about freedom from unrelieved symptoms, capacity to be with family, opportunities for closure, some sense of self-control. And we can give them that if we're communicating and use all of our tools.
And again, from your experience, for those people who might be religious or have a kind of spiritual nature, are they, does that, is that help, have you seen that as helpful?
Well, particularly in this country with the variety, we need to ask the patient, what is, how do they use their religion and their spirituality and religion, and is it important? If it's important, how is it important? Are you connected to someone? And we collaborate with them. If not, we can, if there are fears and life issues that might be related to religious beliefs, we then will bring in the chaplain, because spiritual pain can't be treated with medicines. It need, you need to address it.
And spiritual pain is that kind of existential pain about one's life and the kind of values that you have.
Right, and that's the spiritual existential. Sometimes there's religious pain because one might be trapped in, my religion says I can't do this or I can do that, and we have to help them negotiate that as well with someone who represents their faith.
Let me get, looks like Jane from Haverford to join us on Radio Times. And Jane, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, I just want to say how crucial this is, and I've never forgiven Sarah Palin for misleading the American people about talking to one and to each other, to families. My sons were fortunately informed by their dad when I had a health issue recently, and they knew where to go in the files and take out the living will. And the other comment I want to make real quick is my husband, my late husband, had 9 admissions in about 6 months. He had dialysis. It's a long story. But when I came, when he died, I wanted to run to medical schools around here and tell doctors, tell up-and-coming doctors, talk, don't be afraid. Just because you can't operate or give a treatment or a prescription, you need to know how to talk to the family and the patient and or the patient. I mean, I just sometimes was just left aghast at just, you know, a lot of things happened that I just wasn't prepared for, and I sure could have used some more communication, and it just wasn't there. And I'm not painting doctors with one brush. My husband was a physician. But anyway, those are my comments. Thank you.
Jane, I appreciate those comments. Those are important ones. And I'm assuming for a doctor, maybe even a surgeon, who's, you know, whose job is to get in there and fix something, it might be really difficult to just say no.
It can be, and actually I've had some discussion with our surgeons who they went into surgery because that's what they wanted to do, and they do find it difficult saying that they can't do any more, but it then becomes comforting that but there's someone else who can do more. And so I've often been called in to have that end-of-life discussion or that discussion about progressive disease, either with the surgeon or the surgeon, I'll say, well, look, Dr. So-and-so told you about this. Here, I'd like to talk about what you expect and how we can help that.
And because everything is politicized in this country, Jane was talking about the death panels of a couple of years ago. I don't think it's entirely gone away. But it seems to me that to have a humane and comprehensive healthcare system, we need to figure out how to talk about death and what to do about death. And a lot of money gets spent on people in the last year of their life.
Studies have shown that when hospitals have a up-and-running palliative care program in a 300-bed hospital, it could save the hospital over $1 million a year.
Really?
And it's about de-escalation of care or prevention of the escalation. You know, talk about, no, I don't want to be in the ICU. I want to get home. Get them home with the right support so they don't get readmitted. They don't go to emergency room. So, yes, there is a societal responsibility we have. Some of the death panel stuff was we were trying to get funding for palliative care education. It isn't yet funded like cardiology is. So there was one bill from Senator Wyden. There was another to come up with a billing code so that the doctor who takes the hour to talk can bill something that's realistic. They were going well, then they got put into health care reform and then inappropriately attached to this will save money, and then it blew up.
So it does, I mean, as it stands now, there's nothing in the
Well, because of health care reform, it blew up. Now there is a bill in Congress to try to get funding, so we've got to get this information out to everyone.
I hate to do this at the end of the hour, but I want to make sure that, again, our listeners understand that palliative care different from physician-assisted suicide or assisted suicide. I mean, that's a totally different, and I know you have very strong opinions about that. Go ahead.
The request for assisted suicide is... The best answer to that is intensive palliative care.
Meaning?
Meaning that the patient doesn't usually say, I want to die. They say, I don't want to live like this. The like this becomes the target of our diagnosis and treatment. And we then can help them meet their expectations. And one of the big problems, a survey that recently showed that 70% of the population didn't know what palliative care was, but 50% were worried their doctors wouldn't give them all the options, wouldn't collaborate with other doctors, wouldn't spend enough time with them. So you have this distrust of the healthcare system to open up that door. It's not necessary. I view it as an unnecessary act of harm.
And again, we're almost out of time here, but that actually ends up hurting the patient, because if you can't trust your doctor.
Yes.
Right,
and then the family says, oh, we couldn't get them enough care that they wanted to be killed. I mean, look at the guilt that engenders, because often families want to just know they tried everything, they heard everything. I don't include assisted suicide as everything.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much, Dr. Michael Levy, for joining us today on Radio Times. And he is a vice chair of the Department of Medical Oncology at the Fox Chase Cancer Center, where he's also the director of the Pain and Palliative Care Program. Coming up, actually, I just lost my train of thought there. You don't have to let the conversation stop here on Radio Times on the air. Let us know what you think at our website, whyy.org/radiotimes. And on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, you can also visit our expanded website at whyy.org/radiotimes. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.